Hey everybody, and welcome back to the Improve Photography Podcast. Thank you for the download. Right now you are joined by thousands of photographers from all around the world, and we're all here to learn about photography, to build up our hobby. For some of us, it's a profession. Some of us like landscape or people photography or whatever you like to do. We don't discriminate here. Everybody's welcome as long as you're a photographer. Well, today I'm joined by a really fantastic photographer named Jay Pierstorf. I looked at his portfolio and it's just really beautiful, living down in Arizona, and has just the rich colors of the Arizona desert and wildlife and composites of portraits as well. Really shooting a lot of different things. Jay teaches photography classes locally there in Arizona, and we're really excited to hear everything you have for us, Jay.
Thanks, Jim. It's an honor and a privilege to be on your podcast.
Well, Jay, tell us a little bit about your photography.
Well, I'm an old guy, so I started out in film and way back in the 70s, and have just been shooting ever since. And love digital. Goodbye film. Digital has just been such a great medium with the advance of Photoshop. We can finally do all those things that we just, we would have killed to be able to do in film, but never could pull it off. And now Photoshop and digital photography is just like a dream come true for somebody that's lived that much photography.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, I know you do a lot of photographing animals, and that's kind of what we wanted to talk about today. Animals in the wild, and also just captive in a zoo or wherever you go, an animal shelter, something like that. It looks like you've done a lot of animal and wildlife photography.
Yeah, at the Arizona Sonora Desert Museum, where I teach, one of the classes that we have is a behind-the-scenes photo walk, where we actually go around with one of the keepers, and we photograph captive animals. It's like besides a museum, it's actually kind of a zoo, and so we can get some really, really excellent pictures of animals in that location. But I have looked for animals in the wild as well, and it's certainly a lot more challenging.
Yeah, it can be really challenging. I think one mistake that a lot of wildlife photographers make when they're trying to shoot wildlife is going into the middle of nowhere, where you think there are animals. But the problem is, if you go to the middle of nowhere, there's a lot of space for the animals to hide from you. For example, when I want to shoot, let's say, deer or bear in Idaho, I'm not going to head up into the White Cloud Mountains in the middle of nowhere, Idaho. I've hiked, gone on a 50-miler through the White Clouds, and I'm sure it's full of animals up there. But the problem is, it's a huge area, and the animals know where you are, and so they're not going to get close to you. And I've hiked, 50 miles through there and seen two deer the whole week. When I really want to find deer to photograph, I'm probably going to go somewhere near a campsite, near a state park, where they're used to kind of people being around, and it becomes much easier to photograph them.
Good point. Absolutely. That's one of the things, when you look at how most animals are built, they have very long noses, and they have an acute sense of smell, and that's usually their strongest sense. And when we go out looking for animals in the wild, one of the things that we don't notice is that we smell funny. We have shampoos and conditioners and deodorants and aftershaves and colognes. And animals have such sensitive smell that they can pick up just a couple molecules from a mile away or so. So they're long gone by the time we even get there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's amazing how well many animals can smell. And that's a good point, that it's good to know a little bit about the animal. You don't have to necessarily be a biologist to know everything about the animals that you're going to shoot. But just some basic things like, is the animal that I'm going to shoot colorblind or not? Because maybe you want to wear camouflage. For example, if you're going out to shoot birds, and a lot of photographers will shoot in a little blind. I have a ground blind. That I'll go, I can go out, there's a marsh area, and set up that ground blind and shoot from it. well, you're going to kind of want to know, are the birds you're going to be shooting, are they colorblind? Can they see color? How skittish are they going to be? Are they going to be willing to come right up to you or not? And the same with any animal. Know if it's colorblind. Just know a little bit basics about it. And one tip to do that is look for hunting tips. Just go on a hunting website, whether or not you're a hunter, and just look for kind of what tips they have for getting close to a deer, to a bear, to a coyote, to a whatever. See how they're finding them. And often it's, you know, the exact same technique to get in close to animals for photographers.
Good point. It's exactly the same thing. You're trying to get close to that animal. The other thing that that I think we neglect about when we're trying to get close to animals is their hearing. They hear, that's probably their second strong sense. And so we're making all kinds of sounds. We have zippers and Velcro and nylon fabrics that are making noise. And they're gone before we get there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know one easy way that a lot of photographers like to shoot is in a wildlife sanctuary or a zoo. And I know you've shot in situations like that a lot. What are some kind of tips that you have for people who are shooting captive animals?
Well, and captive animals, and in fact, the biggest tip I think that you've already had on one of your podcasts, and that's get there early. Particularly animals in zoos or institutions like that, they frequently are shifted from a night enclosure to a daytime enclosure first thing in the morning. And so as soon as that place opens, you want to be there, because that pretty much guarantees that the animal is going to be alert and active and out, you know, out and about, moving around for you for at least the first half hour or so. And maybe it'll get too hot and they'll take a nap later in the day. But that being there early, that's a biggie. If you can manage that, and it's surprising how many people that's really hard, but that'll help you a lot right there, just being access to the animal.
And you may also check, especially if you're going to a major location, there are many of these places have photography hours. So check on the website. A lot of zoos have this, wildlife sanctuaries have it, that you can usually pay a couple extra dollars and they'll open the gates early and a flood of photographers will go in and get to shoot. A lot of zoos will do that, you know, on specific days they'll have photography hours. I know when I lived in Florida, there were a lot of wildlife sanctuaries there as well. And almost all of them had some kind of photographer hours. So check their website and call the place that you're going. It's very likely that they do offer that at least sometime during the week. They'll have those hours set apart.
Great advice. Also, and maybe one that you wouldn't think of is to come back around closing time. Again, the animals are being shifted back to their night enclosures, so they're alert. They're checking to see what's going on, and the light can be really striking and beautiful later in the day like that, just before closing. So that's another great time to check.
Well, zoo photography can be a lot of fun, but why would it be interesting to professional photographers, somebody who wants to, you know, really get the ultimate image of a particular animal?
Sure. Great question. You know, in fact, sometimes a lot of people feel like, well, maybe animals shouldn't even be in zoos. They should be wild and they should be free. And for a healthy animal, I couldn't agree more. But mostly at zoos and those type of institutions, they get their animals from rehabilitation clinics. Maybe the animal has been injured, is not suitable to be released back into the wild. They wouldn't survive. And so those are perfect animals for a zoo. So if you're out trying to find an animal, you might, you know, if you're looking for coyotes or deer or bobcats, and you do find one, oftentimes living in the wild is really tough. So there maybe not be the most perfect species. They might have, you know, part of their ear might be skinned, or might have some scars in their fur or something like that. But zoo animals are often pristine, even though they might have had some injury that prevents them from being released in the wild. It's nothing that you can usually see. So they look like a perfect specimen or a perfect ambassador for their species, as we like to say.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Now, when you're shooting at these animals, especially in a zoo, not necessarily in a wildlife sanctuary where sometimes they are roaming a little bit more, but in a zoo, you're always shooting through, you know, a glass, through plexiglass, through a fence, etc. How do you avoid that? How do you get the photo when you're separated with something like that?
Well, it depends on what is separating you. If you've got a fence and you can get close to it, you know, you can put it right up against the lens and often throw it out of focus that way. or you could use a shallow depth of field by using a large lens opening. That will often put the fence out of focus. Glass is a big one because a lot of enclosures have glass as their front window, and so your gadget of the week is a device called a lens skirt. And this is a fabric thing that has a couple...
Whoa. Who said lenses are all female? They might...
Hey. Well, thing,
I have a couple lenses here that are definitely dudes.
Well, I suppose they could have called a lens trouser, but it does look like a skirt because it's flared out. You know, it looks like a skirt that you put over your lens, and then suction cups attach it to the glass. And that eliminates any reflection from behind you or the ceiling or anything else. So it's very, very useful for those type of situations.
Well, how much does this lens trouser cost?
It's kind of pricey. You know, I think for what it is, it's really well made, but it's about $50. And so maybe, you know, if you had good sewing skills, you might be able to make one or something similar to that, or even use a rubber lens hood in a lot of cases.
Yeah, that's a good point. A rubber lens hood would be good for that.
Yeah, but you know, you can take a look at it on their website, and it's really quite a nicely made device. And if I just had to bite the bullet, then I have not been sorry. It's been a great piece of gear for getting through glass and avoiding those reflections.
Well, Jay, when I started this interview, I did not think I would be purchasing a skirt at the end of it. But you know what? Maybe I just will. Well, I have trouble when I'm shooting through glass. Glass is always tough because it messes with the optics.
It does.
In fact, it sounds kind of weird if you haven't done this before, but I would much rather shoot through a chain link fence than through glass. You think a chain link fence is going to ruin your photo, but as long as you can get your lens to touch the fence, or at least get close to it, and as long as there's not sun that's putting glare on the metal, shooting through a metal fence is often not a problem at all, as long as you use a very wide aperture.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And at the Desert Museum where I work, they actually have invented a product a number of years ago. It's called InvisiNet, and it's a stainless steel net that has kind of a dark brown color to it. And if you get the light is just right on that, you can shoot through it very easily. So hopefully maybe some other zoos will pick that up, make our life easier.
Yeah, that'd be pretty cool. There are so many, you know, zoos and places like that I've been to that, you know, the lion's roaring and it looks awesome, but it's just concrete and like PVC pipe back there, and it just looks ugly in the backgrounds. So how can we work with that when you're in a place that just isn't necessarily meant for a nice background?
Pack up and go somewhere else, Jim. most of the modern zoos now have very naturalistic enclosures. That they're trying to make the backgrounds look like where the animal would be in the wild. And so that really helps your photography. They hide the water bowls and the things like this are not visible. The animal can get to them, but they're not out where you see them. So that's the kind of zoo that you want to use for photography that works very well.
Yeah, that's for sure. One point that I want to bring up, the lawyer in me always flares up. I try to put him down, but sometimes he flares up, is that when an animal is owned, then the owner of that animal has the publicity rights to that animal. So if you go and shoot it at a zoo, you're taking pictures of a lion that somebody is paying a lot of money to maintain. And even though you may feel like you have the right to use those animals because you've paid to get in, the opposite is actually true. Just the mere fact of showing that you're willing to pay to get in is showing that there's value in this animal, in seeing this animal. So one thing to be very careful about is don't go to your local zoo, take a picture of a lion, and then upload it for stock photography. You know, you can take the picture. There's nothing wrong with that unless they had some kind of photo policy, which would be, I've never heard of a zoo doing that. But usually you can take the picture just fine. You can share it on your Facebook. You can put it on your Pixoto. But be sure not to use that photo in a commercial context unless you have the rights. Now, what I have found is if you scratch their back, they'll usually scratch yours. And most zoo operators parks or wildlife sanctuaries have no concept of this. Have never even considered, you know, going after somebody because they took a picture of their lion or whatever. So what has worked for me in the past is when I go shoot at a place like this, go take the pictures and then email, you know, ask at the gift shop, say, hey, what's the manager's name and email address? And then just send them an email after, said, hey, I took these photos. I loved being there. You talk about what a great experience is. I'd be happy for you to use these photos for free. I won't charge you a bit. If you wouldn't mind signing this property release that I have attached to the email, would that be okay with you? And universally, I get yeses.
Absolutely. Make contact with them and, you know, find out what their policies are and by all means, get in there and show them your images. Those kind of places, all zoos, you have newsletters for their members and they use photography all the time and they would be thrilled to have great shots of their animals or their exhibits. And, you know, they will work something out. If you take a photo that's that you could potentially sell for $1 million to XYZ company, talk to the zoo and they'll probably work out some kind of a deal with you where, you know, where you can both make a little bit on it. So definitely communicate.
Yeah. And it really depends a lot on where you are. I mean, if you go to the San Diego Zoo, this is going to be pretty tough to work that out. I mean, that is a massive organization. So that's going to be pretty tough to do. But if you go to a small local zoo or especially a wildlife sanctuary that's kind of run by a mom and pop kind of organization with a lot of volunteers, I always get yeses from that kind of places. In fact, I went and shot one. I said, hey, I'm a professional photographer, explained what I was doing. And one said, hey, do you want to go in the enclosure with the jaguar? And I was like, what? And he said, yeah, no, you'll be fine. Just go on in. And so he opens up the gate and I looked at him like, okay, he's going to tell me he's joking any minute. And he's like, no, go ahead in. And he shooed me in and I was like, there's a jaguar in there. And he's like, no, you're fine. Just go in. You can shoot. And I walked in and he shut the gate behind me, which made me even more nervous. And he's like, you're fine. Just relax, relax. And so I started shooting from far across in the enclosure. And he's like, no, scoot up. Go right up in there. I thought, okay, nice kitty. anyway, people are really nice. If you explain what's going on, most of the time, these kind of people are going to be very, very good to work with you.
Absolutely. It's a lot of fun. You know, and one other thing that if we have time to bring up, you know, when you asked about why would you, if he's a professional photographer, why would you go shoot at a zoo? Well, sometimes you might need to photograph an animal that no longer exists in the wild. And you know, we don't maybe think about that, but a good case in point is like the Mexican gray wolf. The last one of those was seen in 1981. And since then, there's been none in Arizona or Mexico. But there's about 600 of them in different zoos and institutions across the U.S. So if you're looking for an exotic animal that's on the endangered species list, that's a possibility for you at those kind of places.
Well, what are some tips for keeping, for not alerting or scaring the animals when you're there, but still getting the photo that you need? How do we do that, especially where it's such a noisy environment?
Absolutely. And I think the mistake that a lot of people make is they think that, you know, if they make some kind of a noise that the animal will react, but they get pretty hardened to, you know, there's a lot of school kids making all kinds of noises quite loudly. And so pretty much the animals ignore that. But the other thing you might check when you get to the zoo, check for feeding schedules, or if sometimes the keepers will have, they'll give little talks about the animals. And whenever there is a keeper around, any animal is going to be alert. They recognize their keepers. And when there's a keeper, even just walking by the front of your enclosure, that might mean something's up. That might mean it's feeding time. That might mean it's vaccination time. But whatever, they're up and around. So that's a really good one. If you can make friends with the keepers or talk to them, you know, if you see them out and about, certainly they're busy, but they always like, you know, they don't mind answering questions. You know, if you've got some brief questions, just say, well, you know, is there our enrichment activities? And these enrichment activities are things that they do for the animal, just so that every day is different. They might take a rattlesnake shed and put it in with the bobcats. All of a sudden something smells different, you know, or they'll take a rock from the wolf enclosure and put it in with the mountain lion. smells different. There's just kind of mixes it up for them. And those are all good shooting opportunities if you can find out when they're going to happen.
Well, very cool. Well, I want to go on and talk about some of the technical things and camera settings and stuff like that, but let's take just a minute and thank our sponsors. I want to take a second and thank Squarespace for their support of the Improved Photography Podcast. Squarespace is the fast and easy way to create your own website, portfolio, or online store. I have my website now up on Squarespace. It was really easy to make. It really took about, I'd say probably 30 minutes, and I had it totally customized, looking how I wanted to, you know, got my logo on there, got all my portfolio uploaded, everything. Like, it was super quick, and it looks awesome on whatever device you're on. It has big pictures and beautiful, clean-looking templates, and you don't have to mess with anything. You don't have to install anything or worry about hosting. They'll do everything for you, starting for just $8 a month. Start a trial with no credit card required, and you can start building your website today. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to go to squarespace.com and use the offer code IMPROVE, and that'll give you 10% off your first purchase to show your support for the Improve Photography Podcast. And we thank Squarespace for their support of Improve Photography. Squarespace, a better web starts with your website. All right, so let's take a second and talk about some of the technical things, the camera settings, you know, for a newer photographer. And then I want to talk about a little bit of the focus and more advanced stuff too. So you know, if somebody comes up to you and says, "Hey, Jay, I don't know what to do. I'm going to the zoo this afternoon. I want to get my camera set up. What do I do?"
Okay, well, what kind of camera are we talking about? Is it Super Zoom or DSLR? Or my advice would be a little bit different, but I think something that certainly applies is if you have a monopod or a tripod, you know, and you're not afraid to pack it around, that's going to improve the quality of your images. They're going to be, by and large, they're going to be sharper.
Yeah, that can definitely be good, especially if you're going in early in the morning when there isn't enough light and you're going to need those slower shutter speeds. So do you usually shoot in aperture priority or manual? What do you shoot in?
I usually shoot manual just because, you know, I'm an old film guy. And it just feels right to me. But I do look and check the histogram to see if I'm in the right ballpark on that. That I can usually, just from experience, can do it. But certainly, I think exposure is the least of your problems. You know, I mean, because modern cameras can pretty much nail it. More what you'll be concerned with is if you're using a zoom lens or a telephoto lens like 400 millimeters, you're going to be concerned with focus and sharpness. And so the focus, you got to focus on the eyes. The eyes are important. When we look at a photograph, we want to see if that animal is looking back at us. So if the eyes aren't sharp, that's a deal breaker. Got to have the eyes sharp. The rest of it's negotiable. But really, the eyes need to be sharp.
One thing that I see a lot in photos from other photographers is sometimes the focus is perfect on the eye and it is sharp, but it doesn't have any catch light in the eye, you know, that little white dot in the eye. So it's just kind of a black blob. And when that happens, it can actually make the eye look blurry, even if it's tack sharp. And so when we're shooting it with animals, both captive or in the wild, can we use flash? Is that going to be all right? Or are we going to scare the animals off?
No, flash is absolutely good across the board. There's usually never any problem at all with the animals. The only exception that I can think of at the Arizona Sonora Desert Museum is on nesting hummingbirds. And during that season, they ask you to turn the flash off because these birds are, they want them to raise young and their eggs to hatch. And that if a photographer is getting really too close and that flash keeps firing, they're afraid that the bird might be scared off the nest. But if you don't have the flash turned on, then you're perfectly fine. You can get whatever distance you need to. But by and large, the catch lights is great. Even if you're 20, 30, 40 feet away from the mountain lion, but putting your flash on and letting it fire will still, catch lights will show up even at that distance, even if the fill doesn't do much else. It's almost not a downside to that. You can pretty much use flash anywhere and it will help.
Yeah, and that makes all the difference. In fact, a lot of photographers are going to use the Better Beamer, which is basically a Fresnel lens that goes in front of your flash, and it's just going to kick that flash out a little bit further. Okay, I'm sorry for the side note here, but I've got to just say, I saw this thing on YouTube the other day, and it's amazing. You know the old TVs that, I mean, not real old, the ones that, you know, even that were flat screens, but were like huge, big, thick things. I don't remember what those are called. The rear projection TVs. Remember those?
Yeah,
that
absolutely.
A lot of people had. Sometimes you still see them in houses, but not too often. They were just gigantic. It was like a piece of furniture. Anyway, if you break one of those apart, and there's a gigantic curved lens in there, and it's a Fresnel lens. Fresnel is F-R-E-S-N-E-L. It's France. Anyway, if you get one of those and you go out into the sun, if you just tip it down, it is instant fire because it's a huge magnifying. You know, you get to use to get the old magnifying glass and burn ants. This is just like a ginormous one. I know I'm down a rat hole, but
solar
seriously,
cooker.
Search on YouTube for fire and rear projection TV. It's awesome. Like you just point it and woof, instant fire. Pretty cool.
Solar cooker.
Yeah, that's right.
Be green and cook your meals that way.
Yeah, why not? You might have some burnt steaks, but it'd work.
Now you have to work it out.
Well, another thing that you mentioned earlier was to ask a keeper when you get to the zoo and to talk with them about where the best opportunities might be. So what kind of information might you be looking for?
Well, you're certainly going to be looking for enrichment times or feeding times or sometimes they'll tell you where an animal is. You might look at an enclosure and you're like, I don't see anything there. And if you can talk to one of the keepers and go, oh, under that bush on the right. Oh, now I see perfectly clear, because in the naturalistic environments that they're creating for these animals, oftentimes their camouflage works quite well in that area. So maybe you don't want to know where it is and they'll point it out to you.
Yeah, the last time I was at a wildlife sanctuary, it was pretty open, and I somehow struck up a conversation with the keeper by accident, and he said, "Oh yeah, one of the monkeys was pregnant or in heat, I don't remember." And he said, "Go over there. That monkey has just been acting wild all day, hooting and hollering and swinging all around." And awesome, because all the animals were asleep, you know, where I was. And I made some really cool shots. So little bits of knowledge like that can really make a big difference in terms of how your photos turn out.
So Jim, let me ask, when you go to the zoo, what's the longest lens you take with you?
I don't take anything longer than a 70 to 200 when I'm shooting at a zoo.
Okay.
One, because I usually when I'm with the kids.
Okay.
It is the main reason. And when I'm with the kids, I'm not going to bring haul out the giant thing. But that's just for logistics, I guess.
Well, the reason I bring it up is sometimes I see people and they have either own or have rented a 600 millimeter. And they spend most all of their time backing up. You know, when you've got animals that are in that close a proximity to you, a 300 or 400 is going to do it. It's going to be plenty for most of the things.
Yeah, actually, it's funny that you say that. And because I went, and this is the situation where it actually worked out well for me. I was in Yellowstone shooting, and on the way back, there was a sanctuary that I stopped at to shoot some wildlife in there. And I did have the 600, and I thought, oh, should I take it in the car or just bring the 7200? And I thought, oh, what the heck, let me try. And I did have to back up, but it was nice because I could go up on a little rise and shoot totally into the enclosure over the fence. And so it just worked perfectly.
Wow.
And I got some just killer shots from doing it. So I definitely agree with you. You know, you go to a zoo, that's going to be way overkill to have a big old fatty lens. But yeah, you never know. Every once in a while, you might it might pay off.
And so the heaviest, most difficult gear to pack around is the one that you need in the wild.
Uh-huh. Yep, that's the truth. Well, in terms of lighting, sometimes we can't be there first thing in the morning. You know, sometimes we are shooting, you know, with the kids, going to the zoo or something like that. Do you have any tips for how we can improve the lighting or what to look for in the lighting when we're out shooting in that kind of condition?
Absolutely. And in Arizona, we don't have very many days like this, but when you see them, and that's an overcast, man, you pack up your gear and you run for the zoo or the places like that. Because when the sky's overcast, then it's like a giant studio softbox. The shadows are soft. The light reaches around. You don't have this dappled lighting that you do in the bright sunlight where light causes harsh shadows through the branches. And when you get shadows on the animals, it's not really as attractive photograph. But you want to make sure that you don't have the sky in the photograph because it'll be white.
Yes, that's a good point. And, you know, shooting on a cloudy day is always nice. It never happens that I say, oh, it's cloudy, I'm not going to go shoot today. I love shooting in the clouds, especially for portraits, for animals, for anything, even landscapes. Oh, it's so nice to have clouds up in the sky. It makes a big, big difference. Makes it a lot easier for sure.
Absolutely.
Well, I saw you were also talking about looking for patterns with birds. Tell me how you might use that in a photo.
Sure. And a great place to use this is if you have a zoo that has a hummingbird aviary, for example, or even a mixed species aviary, where you've got a lot of birds in a concentrated area. And of course, hummingbirds are beautiful to photograph. When they turn towards the light, their feathers fluoresce with different colors, bright oranges or reds, sometimes blues or purples, if they hit just the right way. But of course, the frustrating thing about hummingbirds is that they fly fast and frequently. So you might be all focused in on a hummingbird. You've got them all lined up here. You're perfect. You're on your tripod, and it's all. And then the bird takes off, and like, oh, and so you pack your stuff and you go around to the other side of the enclosure where he went, and you try it again. And just as you get your shot ready to go, he takes off again. So the tip here is that birds, and even wild birds, they use patterns to patrol their territories or to move around, and they pick the same spots all the time. They don't pick a new branch every time they move. They come back to their favorites. So if you'll be patient, even though that hummingbird flew off, wait 10, 15, 20, maybe 30, maybe even a minute, something like that, and they'll come back. So I've had them where, you know, they leave and they come back maybe every 5 or 10 seconds, and we'll give you lots of opportunities to get that shot.
Yeah, that's a great tip. And another thing is, especially where you are in the middle of the day and you just might not get the great background or the lighting isn't very good, if you do focus on those patterns, you know, bring a set of extension tubes, bring a macro lens, bring a close focus filter, something so that you can do that, or just, you know, shoot as tight as you can and then just crop in. But there are beautiful patterns on lots of different animals, on the insects that you may find there, the smaller lizards, the zebras, the everything, and look for those patterns in the animal, just in the shapes and colors that they have. And that can be a great way to pull out a shot in a really difficult situation.
Absolutely. You can spend a lot of time, you know, at the zoos and museums like that, coming up with breaking it down, you know, taking the overall shots and then breaking it down to the parts.
Well, Jay, it's been awesome to have you on the podcast, and I really appreciate all the tips that you've shared. It just really gets you thinking, you know, as photographers, a lot of times we make excuses for not shooting and we wish we were in big exotic places, but you know what? Take your kid to the zoo and bring your camera along and think about some of the things that Jay's shared on the podcast today. And I guarantee you, you'll have some photos that you're proud of when you get back. Absolutely. Otherwise, you sit on the couch and you just wish about that you had a better portfolio and more opportunities to shoot. Well, Jay, in every episode, we share a doodad of the week. And you already talked about the lens skirt, which is an awesome one that I definitely want to link you to. But you also have been using the SX50, the Canon SX50. Tell me about that.
Sure. The SX50 is a bridge camera or a super zoom. And, you know, I think they're about around $350, $400, somewhere in that category price-wise. But the zoom lens that they have on them is an equivalent from I think it's a 25 millimeter all the way to a 1200 millimeter and everything in between. So in one little camera, and it's a 12 megapixel camera, but it shoots raw images if you so choose. And that's one of the attractions for me. It's an amazing little device. And, you know, if you're going to get a 1200 millimeter lens for your DSLR, have you been looking at the prices on those, Jim? They're up there.
Yeah, they are up there. A lot of expensive gear.
So here you can get a 1200 millimeter lens, you know, for under $400, and you get the camera attached to it. Now, it's not going to make you throw your DSLR away, but it nonetheless, you can get some amazing images, and they're not going to fit in your pocket, but they're small enough that, you know, you can carry it around your neck or on a strap, and you hardly know it's there. It weighs very, very little. It's a great camera. I love mine. It's an awesome accessory.
Very, very good point. In fact, two areas that I think that in some ways beat DSLRs are, one, in this super, super telephoto range where you're not going to spend $10,000 on a 600 millimeter lens. You know, this is a great choice. Or go buy a Micro Four Thirds camera and put your 70 to 200 on it with an adapter. Suddenly that 70 to 200 is now a 140 to 400 millimeter lens. And a 400 millimeter lens is going to do you just fine for shooting wildlife. So the other area is in macro photography. You know, if you don't have a macro lens, grab your point and shoot, because it usually will focus very close to the camera. Is it as, you know, you don't have all the advanced controls of a DSLR, but it does a pretty decent job, and it's better than not getting the shot at all if you don't have a macro lens.
Absolutely.
Well, what I want to recommend for this week is a resource on the Improved Photography website, and that is the photo basics. On the podcast, I'm always try to be as careful as I can to talk about the advanced stuff and the nerdy things that I'm always really interested in, and I know many of you are who are the advanced photographers, but I always try to at least explain where we are. And when we talk about things, I try to stop and define different jargon and the technical terms for people who are new, because we have people from all over the spectrum who listen to the show. Well, if you want to catch up quickly, I mean, you can take my online photography class for beginning photographers. I get a lot of great feedback on that on photoclasses.com. But, you know, if that's not in the cards for you, just go to improvephotography.com and click photo basics right there. And I have a 10-page tutorial that's like the first 6 months of your photography, the things you're going to be learning. Squish it into 10 pages, and that's what it is. And it's totally free. It's up there. So if you're a beginning photographer, or, you know, when you talk to a friend and they say they got a camera, point people over there. I spent like a week on that resource, just making it as simple as possible to get started. So I hope you enjoy it. Well, Jay, thank you for being on the podcast. It was awesome to talk with you, and thank you for your tips. I'll be sure to link over to your website in the show notes. That's at jpierstorf.net. If you're not sure how to spell that, just head on over to the show notes. Jay has some really, really nice work. It was a pleasure to talk with you, Jay.
Thanks, Jim. It's been my pleasure.